Our second reading from the Word of God is taken from the Holy Gospel, Mark chapter 4, beginning in verse 35 and extending to the end of the chapter, which is verse 41. Please stand for the reading of the Holy Gospel. On the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and the other little boats were also with him. And a great thunderstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The Gospel of our Lord.
Thanks be to you, O Christ.
Please be seated. The passage we have before us in the Gospel is one that the early church fathers loved to allegorize, and many have followed in their train. It kind of lends itself to that. It's an easy preach that way. A very good example of that is how Augustine treats it. He is working with the concept of what do you do when you're being insulted and offended, or what do you do when you're under temptation. And he turns to this passage before us, Jesus calming the Sea of Galilee, and this is how Augustine, the great preacher, deals with it. When you have to listen to abuse, that means you're being buffeted by the wind. When your anger is aroused, you are being tossed by the waves. So when the winds blow and the waves mount high, the boat is in danger. Your heart is imperiled. Your heart is taking a battering. On hearing yourself insulted, you long to retaliate, but the joy of revenge brings with it another kind of misfortune, shipwreck. Why is this? Because Christ is asleep in you. What do I mean? I mean you have forgotten his presence. Rouse him then. Remember him. Let him keep watch within you. Pay heed to him. A temptation arises. It is the wind. It disturbs you. It is the surging of the sea. This is the moment to awaken Christ and let him remind you of those words, "Who can this be? Even the winds and the sea obey him." Now preach. People are on a journey like traveling the sea. They are represented by the boat, and somebody insults you and offends you. Well, that's life giving you a hard time. You find yourself tempted. Well, that's like water coming into the boat. Jesus is asleep in you, but you can go wake him up, and if you wake him up, well, he'll deal with all the troubles of life on this journey you're on. As I said, not a preach, but maybe it might ought to not. It's easy. In fact, it could easily find its way into a book titled, I don't know, Your Best Life Now. I mean, it would fit. But is that really actually why Mark, the writer of our gospel, tells us about this event? Does he want you to picture yourself as a boat crossing the Sea of Galilee and to allegorize the storm as your troubles? Is that really what he wants to convey to you? Is that what the Apostle Peter meant to convey to his hearers when he preached this account time and time again, and that's why it got into the gospel? When Peter stood up and said, "There was a day I was on a boat, and let me tell you what happened," was he wanting his hearers to allegorize the story or not? I would suggest the answer is no. That's not their primary focus. Now, I'm not saying that Christ is not in you and that you can't turn to him in times of being insulted or being tempted. But I am saying Mark and Peter have a different reason for telling you the story, and I think that the clue is in the last verse. In the last verse, the apostles are in the boat with Christ, but they're not talking to Christ, they're talking to each other, and they say to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Who is this guy? Who can he possibly be? This is not a normal person, so who is he? They want to know. If you have been keeping attentive count of Mark's book as we have been moving through it, you probably are able to ramble off a number of times where the question of exactly who is this man has been brought up. It starts at the very first verse of the gospel. Mark has the audacity to tell us he is going to write about someone who is, quote, the Christ, the Son of God, end quote. And if we are original readers, we're going to say that is quite a claim you've just made. He is the Christ, he is the prophet, the priest, and the king. Not only that, he is the very Son of God. Our initial response is going to be, yeah, pull the next one. Because actually, there's a lot of people out there that people are making very great claims about. And if I'm an original hearer, I'm probably just a little cynical because I've seen all kind of religious teachers and leaders come and go. And you're telling me that the one guy who was promised to be the king, the priest, and the prophet is your guy, and he is the Son of God. Okay, prove it. Well, actually, that's kind of what Mark is doing. As the story goes by, he is substantiating what he has said about this very unique one. If you do not believe he is the prophet, the priest, and the king, if you do not believe he is actually the Son of God, let me show you. And then as we have moved through it, we have seen this question of who is he come to the surface again and again. Chapter 1, beginning at verse 27. Then they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? What is it? We have no idea what we're watching. What is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." Moving into chapter 2, the issue of who is this guy comes front and center in verse 6 and 7 and verse 12. And some of the scribes were sitting there and reasoning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak blasphemies like this? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" And then in verse 12 we read, "And immediately he arose, took up the bed, and went out in the presence of them all, so that all were amazed and glorified God and said, We've never seen anything like this." Questions of identity, questions of the nature of what they're watching. They don't know, but they realize this is something really special, really amazing. Chapter 2 and verse 16. "And when the scribes and Pharisees saw him eating with the tax collectors and sinners, they said to his disciples, How is it that he eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners?" Who is this guy that he would do that? Why does he think that's a good idea? Again, questions of identity. And then in chapter 3, in verse 20 through 22, we have people who declare they know who he is. We read, "Then the multitude came together again, so that they could not so much as eat bread. But when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold on him, for they said, he is out of his mind. This is a statement of identity. This is a statement of nature. We know who he is. He's our elder brother. He's our son. And he's nuts. Now, odds are they've got it wrong, but they're working with the idea of the question of who is he. And then after that we read, and the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, he has Beelzebub, and by the ruler of the demons he casts out demons. So again, they also are sure who he is. He is a demon-filled, we call him an antichrist, but that wouldn't really work here. He's bad. He's evil. We know who he is. But you can see how this theme of who is this guy, what is he? Peter has been building us account by account to answer the question. And this account ends with them saying, who is he? So they are asking the question. Years ago, when Carmen and I were part of a little countercultural Jesus people kind of church, we did a lot of door-to-door evangelism. We were in a young people's church, and they were into knocking on doors, and we did that. And one of the questions that we would ask people as part of our standard evangelism is, who do you think Jesus is? And 99.7% of the time, we get the exact same answer. Can you give me the answer that they would say? What do you say?
He's love.
Actually, that's a great answer, but that requires people to have thought. And they haven't, really. They had a standard answer, and they would say he is the Son of God, which is what Mark told us in verse 1:1, so it's the right answer. But then the follow-up question would be, what do you mean by that? And the answer would be, there will be an answer. They just say it. When I taught reasoning, when I taught thinking at the college level, one of the things that I would introduce to my students is that there are three kinds of knowledge. The best kind of knowledge is useful knowledge. You know what you know and you know how to use it. The second kind of knowledge is errant knowledge. You think you know something, but you're dead wrong. But to you, you think it's knowledge, so you've incorporated it into your knowledge base. You are 100% off base, but it's knowledge to you, even though you're wrong. And then thirdly, there is what's called dead knowledge. This is where you can parrot something, but you don't have any idea what it means. And people actually have a huge amount of dead knowledge, much more than they think they do. For those people that we were evangelizing, that Jesus is, quote, the Son of God, was dead knowledge. They had heard it in their churches, or they had heard it from grandma. They had heard it in their confirmation class, of Jesus is the Son of God. But it really didn't mean anything to them. They actually had no answer for who he was. So, the question of who is this guy? It's really kind of important. So who is he? Who is this? It's not a very big passage, but I identify 8 real and true answers to the question just from these few verses. The first answer is that he's a man. He's a man who can have a long day of work, he can get tired, and he can be exhausted. The event starts with, quote, on the same day, and it seems to be a reference back to the parable of the sower, where Mark has told us he told a lot of parables. He's been teaching people all day, and so really he's tired. And then Mark emphasizes that when they go across the lake, they take him just as he was. In other words, he's not really had time to rest. He's not really had time to get anything to eat. He's not had any time to wash up. They're just going. And so he's a guy. He's a guy who says, okay, you row, and I'm going to go to sleep. He is like any other normal human being. But that is but one of 8 insights one can draw. He may be a man, normal man, but he's not just a man. He is the one who amazingly has no need to fear nature's churning. There is nothing for nature to make people feel very small very quick. We feel big, we feel significant, and then let natural law have its way just briefly, and suddenly we feel like a speck in the universe. The first church I was the official pastor of was outside of Danville, Kentucky, and we lived in Asbury Sound. What is that called? Wilmore, that's right. We would drive back and forth from Wilmore to the Danville area on a regular basis. There's a nice road that runs it, and as you would travel, there's this one spot where this beautiful stone home dating back to before the Civil War would sit on an open field, a large home, three stories, big house. I suspect it was probably some plantation house, and it was lovely. And it was a part of the landscape. It rose majestically above the flat plain, and you just felt it had been there since dirt. And you drive by it. Well, one day I drove by it, but it wasn't there. We were 15 minutes behind a tornado that had come through. The sky had turned to that color that the sky turns when a tornado has been. And where that house stood was literally nothing. No stone, no evidence it was there, except for one pipe that worked its way out of the ground, and it was attached to a bathtub. And everything else was gone. The next day I read that no one had been killed, that the owner of the house had been in that tub, and he had watched the entire house leave, but he had survived. But imagine how small this guy must have felt when the stones of the ages were disappearing all around him and he was holding onto the tub. Carmen works with a woman whose father died in the Katrina floodings. Small world that you would know somebody like that. What it must have seemed to him as all the oceans poured into his house. When nature decided we don't need land here anymore. When everything turned to water. Charles Spurgeon made the comment that human beings are like bubbles in a stream. They bubble up from underneath and they rise just briefly in the waters. But it is brief, and when they hit the top, they pop, and it is as if they were never here. And he's right. But we don't feel that until something like this storm on the Sea of Galilee happens. In preparing for this sermon, I did a lot of reading about the geography, and the Sea of Galilee has come down in a bowl, and there are major wind patterns that come through this bowl, and within a moment you can have a storm like this. It's not really that uncommon, but when it hits the Sea of Galilee, it busts loose like nobody's business, and it is nature's fury in spades. You think you're at the end of the world. Well, they did think they were at the end of the world. They were panicking. All of them but one. One of them was asleep at the back of the boat. And the water was pouring in on him, and he was wet. And he was being tossed. And people all around him were panicking, and the tumult must have been huge. And there was not a hint of fear in him at all. There he lay, very, very comfortable, very, very secure, where normal mortal men rightly were panicking for their lives. This is someone who doesn't have to fear nature. That is a very, very special person. In fact, not only does he not have to fear nature, he can talk to it and make it do what he wants. All he has to do is speak. And nature snaps too. In fact, nature in its greatest tumult, nature in its absolute most highest destructive power, all this one has to do is say the word, and nature perfectly obeys. And I mean perfectly. Peter makes a point of telling you that when he spoke to the wind and the waves, both of them were still, and that breaks natural law. Because the wind whips up the waves, and when the wind dies down, the waves are still moving around. For hours, you will still have the busting of the waves, but not when this one speaks. When this one says, knock it off, wind and wave immediately obey. And the Greek text is very picturesque. Mark says it is as smooth and calm as glass. The water itself leaps to and obeys his word, and there is not a wave to be seen. There is not a breeze in the sky. When he talks to nature, it just does whatever he says. Where have we seen that before? Well, really, we have to hearken back to Genesis 1. In Genesis 1:1, we have creation ex nihilo. God decides he wants stuff, and suddenly stuff exists. But what he creates is nature in a form that is churning and void. All the stuff is there, but he doesn't create it shaped and molded. And for six 24-hour periods, God speaks to creation, and creation leaps the moment he talks. You know, I think there should be light, so light appears. I think land should rise up through the water, and so it does. God merely speaks, and creation jumps to his command. Natural law, which did not exist just a moment ago, suddenly, immediately shapes itself when God tells it to. When you watch somebody talk to nature and say, jump, and nature says, how high, you are looking at God Almighty. And this may be the most important point of who he is from our text for our current age. Every age and era has its own mythology. Everyone does. It is the human condition to ask the question, what is the nature of reality? How did creation get here? And every human age does answer that question, and that becomes a mythology. Our current mythology says, how did creation get here? Well, natural law created it. It permeates our classrooms. It permeates our television. Why is there anything at all? Oh, natural law created it. It's interesting. Where did natural law come from? Oh, well, natural law has always been here. Carl Sagan says, the universe, all there is, all there ever was, all there ever will be. And then he gets that smug look on his face and holds his pipe and looks like he's very important. That's the current mythology. Natural law created everything. That makes natural law divine, by the way. When we Calvinists ask the question, what is God in the Shorter Catechism? We answer the question with, God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. In his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. Well, Carl Sagan has just said that the natural laws are infinite. They have always been here. They have no creator. They are eternal. And they are unchangeable. The natural law. So Carl has a God. It's just the natural laws. Well, that ain't exactly true. The fact of the matter is that the natural laws are like everything else in creation. They have a cause, they have an origin. They are not immutable. They are not unchangeable. They are not eternal. Before Genesis 1:1, there is no gravity. Before Genesis 1:1, there is no laws of logic. Before Genesis 1:1, there is no light. There is no law at all. There is true and absolute void to the point you can't define void. There's nothing. But natural law knows that this is not true. Natural law recognizes its creator. Natural law recognizes its shaper. Natural law hears the voice of God in this one in the boat, and it immediately does what he says. And what happened on the Sea of Galilee that day is what is happening this very moment. Again, turning to what confession we make to the world, this time from the Heidelberg Catechism, we answer a number of questions very significantly. What do you believe when you say, "I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth"? Answer: that the eternal Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who of nothing made heaven and earth with all that in them is, who likewise upholds and governs the same by his eternal counsel and providence, is for the sake of Christ, his Son, my God and Father. So we declare that he is upholding all things by his providence. So we ask the question, what do you understand by the providence of God? And the answer is, the almighty, everywhere present power of God, whereby, as it were, by his hand, he still upholds heaven and earth with all creatures, and so governs them that herbs and grass, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, meat and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty, indeed all things come not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. And then the last question, what does it profit us to know that God created and by his providence upholds all things? The answer is that we may be patient in adversity, thankful in prosperity, and for what is future have good confidence in our faithful God and Father, that no creature shall separate us from his love, since all creatures are so in his hand, that without his will they cannot so much as move. The section of the Catechism assigns that to God the Father, and rightly it should. But the Gospel of Matthew ends with this one in the boat making quite the claim. It ends with verse 18 of Matthew 28, and Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." We confess that God the Father upholds all things and governs all things, that just as much as when the one in the boat spoke to nature that day, he is directing and guiding all things. And the one in the boat says, that is the Father's business, but he has given it to me. Today, this very day, why do the atoms in the universe hold together? It is because Jesus the Christ wills it so. Why do things happen this day? For good or ill. They have come across his desk just as he spoke to the winds and the waves. He is the one who upholds nature. He is the one who directs it. That is what Peter and Mark want you to realize. He is the creator God who commands nature and it obeys. And it's a very specific kind of command he gives. Commentators are fascinated by a little word that Mark uses. Now, Mark is not the only one to use it. Matthew and Luke use the same word when they talk about what Christ has said. He doesn't just command the elements, he rebukes them. The word has the connotation you would expect. It is, you've been bad, I am correcting you. And they wonder why it is that the gospel describes it so. They wonder, does it have to do with where they're going? Because all three of the Gospels that share this account put it before Christ confronts the demon-filled people in the Gentile section on the other side of the lake. Is it that the demons are attempting to keep the Son of God at bay? Have they attacked the boat? Are we giving a certain preview of coming attractions? The answer is maybe, actually. It's hard to say definitively. That's not what's happening. But my guess is it more has to do with the nature of creation that it has been cursed. Why do tornadoes bust through our properties and take our houses? Why do floods pour into our cities and drown our people? It is because God has cursed the earth. Those things did not happen before that. And paradoxically, though it is God's curse, it is described also as his enemy. The nature of the curse is that all things tend towards death. God says to mankind, you're going to have trouble when you go to work. You're going to have trouble when you bear children. You're going to have trouble when you relate to one another. And at the end of all this, you die. Everything tends to death. And yet, when the Spirit of Christ speaks through Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 26, we are told the last enemy that will be destroyed is death. God's curse, which he has placed, is strangely also something he absolutely hates and abhors. The curse destroys life. The curse harms mankind. The curse is something God will destroy one day. And Jesus Christ, with his followers, stands up and rebukes it. This world is not the way it is supposed to be. R.C. Sproul, who normally we are supposed to bow down and say, St. Sproul said, blessed be, made a comment a few years ago that, quite frankly, is absolutely, teetotally, and undefensibly wrong. When being asked about creation, he was asked, how old do you think the world is? And his response was, I don't know, which is fine. But then he said, I believe the Bible is inerrant, and I also believe the book of nature is inerrant. God reveals himself in two books, which, again, that's true, he does. And since the Bible is inerrant, obviously the book of nature is inerrant. So whatever we study in nature is also going to be inerrant, just like the Bible is. That can't possibly be true. Because nature is cursed. Nature now contains worms in Africa that feed off the human eyeball. Does that tell you about the goodness and love of God? Does that show you his incredible blessing in nature? It will show you that he's wrathful, but it will not show you the world he first made. The world he first made didn't have that. It doesn't have anything like that. It doesn't have floods. It doesn't have tornadoes. It doesn't have fires that burn the house down. It doesn't have sorrow. It doesn't have young death. It doesn't have tragedy. All of that's the curse. And if you study nature now, it's not inerrant. A book of God, yes, but one that's been left out in the rain. And the pages are now drenched with water and the ink is running. This is not an inerrant book. And Jesus Christ stands up to nature's power of death and destruction, which is part of the curse, and he rebukes it. This is the one who has the right to tell nature, knock it off. He is also the one who may seem to not be paying much attention to you at times. The picture is very clear. They are afraid they are going to drown, and nobody should hold them in contempt for such a fear. Mark tells us the water is already spilling into the boat. It is coming in bucketfuls. The boat is tossing and turning, and they are rightly afraid for their lives. And there lays Christ asleep. Why? Well, it doesn't actually say. But they themselves are a little curious about that. How can you possibly lay there and sleep? Well, he does. And so if we are going to define who is this guy by this story, he is the one who may sleep a little longer than you're comfortable with. They are afraid for their lives. They are in desperate straits. And they don't know why he doesn't rise to help them. Eventually he does. But not quite as soon as they want. That is something to remember if we are perhaps moving a little close to allegory. It is the nature of Christ to move when he wishes. But thanks be to God, he is also the one who is willing to hear perhaps not as pious petition as it should be and not respond with rebuke. In the other Gospels, in Matthew and in Luke, we are told that the disciples turn to Christ and say, Master, we perish. And I'm sure they did. I'm sure that there's a babel here and they're trying to wake him up and they're saying all kinds of things. But Peter, blessed, honest Peter, tells us exactly what perhaps he said, somebody said, what's the matter with you? Why are you letting us perish? There is a sense in the statement that cannot be missed of accusation. What's wrong with you? That's really not the best way to speak to the Christ, the Son of God. But it is, in fact, a crisis. It is a moment of terror. And they can be forgiven for what they say, but it comes roughly from the heart. And the heart here says, God, what is wrong with you? Why do you leave me to suffer? Christ will ask, why do you have no faith? But the holy God would have every right to absolutely blast whoever it is who said, what's wrong with you? But he never does. He rises. He rebukes the wind, he rebukes the waves. He is the hearer of honest and true prayer. Even if perhaps what we say is not what should be said, he is a father more willing to hear us than we are willing to make it sound right. And he is the one who demands our faith. At the end of the account, Christ turns to them and says, why do you have no faith? It's a simple question, but it lays claim to faith. Have you not seen who I am yet, says Christ? I demand your faith. Faith is at the very essence of our covenant with God. We are united to Christ by faith. Faith is very significant. What is the definition of faith? Well, you should know if you have gotten through question 21 of the Catechism. True faith is not only a sure knowledge, so that's its first part, whereby I hold for truth all that God has revealed to us in his word, which is the second part, but also, and here is the third part, a hearty trust, which the Holy Ghost works in me by the gospel, that not only to others, but to me also, forgiveness of sins, everlasting righteousness, and salvation are freely given by God merely of grace, only for the sake of Christ's merits. Faith is to know, faith is to believe to be true, and faith is to believe it is true of me. And Christ looks at his apostles, and he says, "Have you not known me? Have you not come to realize I am legitimate, that I truly am concerned for you, and that I am concerned for those I speak to? And have you not realized my care for you? Why is it that your heart seems to be devoid of understanding that I am yours, that I have given myself to you? Why is it you have no faith?" The seventh answer to the question, who is this, is this is the one who deserves and demands your faith. But the last definition may be why we have problems with that, because it is that he is the one who by his glory, by his working of power and grace, makes our flesh afraid. Isn't the last verse of our passage deliciously ironic? It says, "And they feared exceedingly." The storm's over. They had been afraid of the wind and the waves, and rightly so. They had turned to the one in the boat for help, and that was where to turn. And he had done exceedingly abundantly more than they had expected. He had stood up and he had spoken to nature, and nature had snapped to and obeyed. And now that the water is calm, now that there is no wind, they are exceedingly afraid. They ask, "Who is this?" It was his glory he has just manifested. It was his grace to them he has just given. He has acted on their prayers, and they are filled with fear of him. The Gospel of Luke makes it even more emphatic. They are afraid of him. And they ask, "Who is this? Who could it be?" John Calvin, in his instruction on faith in the early chapters, says that if we were not fallen people, if we were not damaged in holiness, righteousness, and knowledge, we wouldn't need a Bible. Because everything in nature, even cursed as it is, would give us a perfect picture of God. That part of the reason why nature can't be inerrant is because of us. We're drain damaged. We just don't get it. Christ says you have no faith. And it's obvious because they're afraid. The flesh recoils in the presence of goodness. The flesh recoils in the presence of his giving. The flesh crawls under the seat of the boat, afraid of the God who has just left it. Because that is who we are in our flesh. Let God manifest. Let God answer our prayer in powerful ways, and the flesh will recoil. Such is our ruin, but such is his grace. Who is this guy? Well, he's a man, and he gets tired. But he's also the Lord and Creator of nature, and he demands your faith.